Good morning. Welcome. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. That means our invitation is to all, and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. And if you have brought family or friends, please introduce them, or visitors can introduce themselves. And I am Robin Proud. I'm one of the rotating speakers here. The lighting of the candle here, if you can assist. And just a short message from Helen Keller, who we just heard about. Alone, we can do so little. Together, we can do so much. Well, when I come here, there's usually a book behind it. And today's book is After the Vote Was Won, The Later Achievements of Suffragists by Catherine H. Adams and Michael L. Keane. Now, I wouldn't recommend this as an actual read because it's more of a reference. There is a chapter summarizing the long fight for women's suffrage in the United States. The rest of the book spotlights women who went on to make a difference in various fields. I'll tell you about a few of them today, and we'll look at how this is relevant for us today. Some scholars looked at how few women actually voted, let alone ran for office in the 1920s, and they concluded that suffrage was a failure or had limited impact. In 1920, 37% of women voted. In 1924, common wisdom held that women would support the progressive candidate, our friend Robert La Follette, but actually more women voted for the Republican. Early that year, 1924, an article in the Atlantic Monthly stated, "American women generally are not interested in public affairs, national or local, in the concrete or the abstract." The New York Times, which the authors of this book say was anti-suffrage, was very happy about this turn of events. They wrote, "One bright ray of sunshine illumines the drab picture. Women are still as gentle, as feminine, as lovable as ever." So 100 years of being disregarded by the press. However, these statistics don't tell the whole story. In some Western states like Kansas, women did make up about 50% of the vote. And there was no systematic reporting of voting, so we don't have really good statistics. Of course, women did not start running for office in any visible numbers for decades. One place that women did make a difference was in lobbying for and voting for prohibition. That was the main reason brewery companies, such as those in Milwaukee, actively campaigned against votes for women. They correctly guessed that women would support prohibition. Now, today, prohibition, which is, of course, fits with our 1920s theme, seems rather quaint and it's charming or even glamorous. But alcohol was the drug problem of the day. Many suffragists supported temperance because they knew of so many instances where men spent all their paycheck on drink or went home to abuse their wives and children. So what this book posits is that the influence of the women's movement went way beyond the vote. Over and over, women took what they learned from their activism and channeled it into their areas of interest. Some of them had already tried to start careers in science, the arts, and so on, only to be dismissed because of their gender. They decided the only way to get equal opportunity was to get the vote. Others had no idea before the movement that they had the ability to speak in public, organize groups, write articles, travel around the country, and so on. And there's a quote here. "As Elizabeth Stuyvesant, who was struck by a soldier, arrested and sentenced to 3 days in jail for picketing on July 4th, 1917, wrote of her fellow suffrage prisoners, there was not one of us who did not come out of that experience with less awe of policeman, judge, and established ideas, and with a clearer understanding of the true nature of authority." So we'll look at a few women and what it can tell us about today. And at the end, I'd love to hear from some of you how you've been involved in the community throughout your lives and how that shaped you. So here's somebody in the arts. Louisine Havermeyer was born in 1855 to a wealthy family. She met the artist Degas and Cassatt in Paris, and with her husband, amassed probably the finest art collection in America. But when her husband died, she suffered from depression. Then she received a letter from her friend, the artist Mary Cassatt, urging her to, quote, go in for the suffrage. So she worked with Harriet Stanton Blatch, the daughter of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the leader of the movement at that time. She organized public art exhibitions for a fee, which went to the cause of suffrage. And she became a speaker for the cause. At her death, she left the great majority of her paintings to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, so you may have seen them. Another was Rhoda Kellogg, from a conservative Minneapolis family. You could say she was radicalized in college. She joined her university's Equal Suffrage Association. She didn't march or picket, but with friends, she went to observe the trial of those who had. When she and her friends applauded the defendants, the judge ordered these university students to spend a night in jail. Rhoda was totally unprepared for this experience and was shocked that an American citizen could be so treated. The other women educated her on her lack of rights. She began to join protests herself, including one that earned her a 5-day sentence in which she participated in a hunger strike. Although it took 2 more years for the suffrage amendment to be passed, Rhoda Kellogg's life had been changed. Instead of her plan of teaching for a couple of years and getting married, she took a graduate degree in education, moved to San Francisco, and worked to promote universal kindergarten. She wrote and spoke publicly about many issues of education and parenting. She became a specialist in children's art, maybe the first to write about how children's art reflects their development. Betsy Graves Reynaud from Michigan wanted to be a painter, but her father discouraged it as, quote, inappropriate for a woman, not at all conducive to a home and family. She actually ran away from home to study at an academy in Cincinnati and later Boston. The condescension and outright discrimination she faced in her field led her to the suffrage movement. She was arrested and jailed multiple times. And what she took from this was, according to this book, she had proved that she could picket and she could survive a jail sentence, so she could also pursue a career as a painter that would make a difference to herself and her nation. She took on a project of painting those who were never celebrated with portraits, including a series of African Americans. She even convinced the Smithsonian Institution to take one of her paintings. She continued this project throughout her life. In 1950, her portrait of Paul Robeson was barred from a show because the State Department and, of course, the House Un-American Activities Committee considered him a communist. After speaking and writing for suffrage, it was natural for many women to go into various levels of education and study. Mary Agnes Chase, from a young age, had devoted herself to the study of plants, especially grasses. Her family had no money, and college was out of the question for most girls in 1890. She worked as a proofreader while pursuing on her own her interest in botany, reading everything she could, and making expeditions outside her home of Chicago to sketch and write about wild plants. She found a mentor who was a botanist. He taught her in exchange for her illustrations in his published papers. She did later do illustrations for the Field Museum in Chicago, and then the USDA Bureau of Plant Sciences in Washington, D.C. This was an excellent opportunity, but as a woman, she was only allowed to illustrate, not to participate in scientific analysis, which she wanted to do. Apparently, collecting and drawing pretty pictures of plants seemed a safe occupation for females. Another mentor hired her as a scientific assistant, which allowed her to contribute to the study of wild and commercial grasses. But when she wanted to go on a study project in Panama, she was turned down because there was no dormitory for women. She would have been the only one. A spokesman for the group said, "Let us keep a place where real research men can find quiet, keen intellectual stimulation, freedom from any outside distractions." Not long after that, Chase joined Alice Paul's confrontational suffrage group. She attended rallies, was jailed and refused bail, instigated a hunger strike, and was force-fed. Her employer, the USDA, threatened her with dismissal for conduct unbecoming a government employee. After this experience, Chase collaborated largely with other women in her work, and with another excluded group, Latin Americans. With little or no funding, she traveled to places like Brazil for months at a time, staying with missionaries and other locals. She herself became a mentor to numerous women who followed in her footsteps. She was able to maintain her own career, ending as a senior botanist at the USDA, publishing many scientific papers and books, and receiving an honorary doctorate at the age of 89. This brings us to Helen Keller, someone we all know about, but in her tidied up image of the unfortunate child saved by her teacher and turned into an inspirational figure. She used her own example to lobby for education for other people with disabilities, but who knew that she left the socialists because they were not radical enough? She was a dedicated suffragist and a radical in general. In 1905, she wrote, "The avenues of usefulness open to me were not many." She was referring not to her blindness or deafness, but to her gender. As a socialist, she said, "Poverty is abominable, unnecessary, and a disgrace to our civilization." She blamed the capitalist system as fundamentally wrong, radically unjust, and cruel. Her support of socialism shocked the country, she said. Wrote, "For several months, my name and socialism have appeared often together in the newspapers. A friend tells me that I have shared the front pages with baseball, Mr. Roosevelt, and the New York police scandal. Reporters claimed that the poor, innocent blind girl was being manipulated by Ann Sullivan and her Marxist husband." Helen pushed back, saying her beliefs were her own, derived from reading and life experience. Helen Keller was insistent on the subject of women's suffrage. "What dignity do women have as citizens when they may not even elect those who shall decide for them vital questions affecting food, clothing, shelter, and education?" In 1913, Helen labeled herself a militant suffragist and backed the more radical approach of the Pankhursts in England, and they were doing things like breaking windows and chaining themselves to buildings. She said, "I am a militant suffragette because I believe that suffrage will lead to socialism, and to me, socialism is the ideal cause." She attended parades and conventions, speaking regularly. Then she decided the socialist cause wasn't radical enough. She joined the IWW, International Workers of the World. She said she did it because the Socialist Party was too slow. So we don't know any of these things, right? We see this tendency a lot to tidy up people and make them very sweet and saintly. We see it with Martin Luther King as well. Oh yes, he was just a nice, peaceful guy and not a rabble rouser at the time. They certainly knew that he was. After the vote for women was won, Helen dedicated herself to advancing educational and career opportunities for the blind. She said they do not want to be fed and clothed and housed by other people. They want to work and support themselves. She supported the Social Security Act of 1935 and lobbied for an amendment that supported vocational training for the blind. But she never lost her focus on greater societal changes. She said in 1924, "So long as I confine my activities to social service and the blind, they compliment me extravagantly, calling me Archpriestess of the Sightless, Wonder Woman, and a modern miracle. But when it comes to discussions of poverty, and I maintain that it's the result of wrong economics, that the industrial system under which we live is at the root of much of the physical deafness and blindness in the world, that is a different matter." She was especially incensed at the patronizing tone of those who said her beliefs came from her limited development. So we've seen some women who went on to work in arts and education. Just a couple others. Alice Robinson co-founded the Women's National Press Club in 1919 and started a publication called the Congressional Digest, which wrote about controversial national questions. Louise Bryant is someone you may remember from a long ago film called Reds. As the wife of John Reed, she accompanied him to Russia at the time of the revolution. She interviewed both Lenin and Trotsky and wrote about daily Russian life. In the 1920s, she traveled throughout Europe and had the first interview with Mussolini. Jeanette Rankin, a suffragist and pacifist, became the first female member of Congress, where she voted no on entry to World War I. She ran for the Senate and lost, but in 1940, she was again elected and she once again voted against a war. While there were about 50 votes against entering World War I, in World War II, she was the solitary no vote. Sue Shelton White went to law school. and was the actual writer of the first version of the Equal Rights Amendment, which Alice Paul started promoting right after suffrage was approved. Dorothy Day, who was mentioned in the song, turned her experience in jail for suffrage protests into a lifelong crusade to reform the prison and justice systems. So there are many more examples. The authors of this book conclude, they found in suffrage a model that affected them for the rest of their lives. The campaign confirmed to them that they could and did matter, that they could take on risks to their bodies and reputations, that they could extend to others the choices they had sought for themselves. So why am I bringing you this today? Well, I always like to talk about interesting people, but this made me think, what does it mean to devote your life or even part of your life to activism? In my generation, young people were galvanized by the Vietnam War and the draft. Anyone remember the draft lottery? And your number was 7, 8, yes. And if you weren't at risk, you knew someone who was being sent to a war that we might not have even believed in. But after the war ended, this generation didn't necessarily retreat to private life. Many got involved in the new ecology movement that started with Earth Day 1970, the women's movement, gay rights, anti-nuclear campaigns, opposition to American involvement in Central America. And this tallies with a recent op-ed in the New York Times by Bill McKibben and Akea Windwood of the organization Third Act. And this came out on January 23rd as I was working on this talk. It says, the case for going gray and staying blue. And just a couple excerpts here. A lot has been written about the impact of young voters in November's contests, and rightly so. But there were also intriguing hints of what looked like a gray countercurrent that helped damp the expected red wave. So there's this common wisdom that people get more conservative with age. They said, in the 63 most competitive congressional districts, where the margin in the House was decided, we found some fascinating numbers. In early summer, Republicans were leading 50-40%. But on election day, voters over 65 actually broke for Democrats in those districts, 49-46. This doesn't surprise us at Third Act, a recently formed group organizing older Americans for progressive action. We are nonpartisan, but we've learned that this demographic is far less settled than people sometimes suppose. Some of the issues that benefited Democrats are obvious, of course. Republican messaging included calls for weakening Social Security and Medicare. This was written before that State of the Union speech. But something else happened too. When the Supreme Court tossed out Roe v. Wade in early summer, most of the pictures were of young women protesting, appropriately. But people we know in their 60s and 70s felt a real psychic upheaval. Some of our members helped organize access to abortion before Roe was decided in 1973. They don't want to go back. And it's not only abortion. The Supreme Court also took on the Clean Air Act of 1970 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. We helped win these fights once, turning out by the tens of millions to oppose the war in Vietnam or for the first Earth Day. And we can help win them again. We have the muscle memory of what organizing on a big scale feels like. Hundreds of us from around the country converged on Nevada in the days before the midterm vote because we determined, correctly as it turned out, that it might be the place where control of the Senate would be decided. We may walk a tad slower door to door, but in this case, slow and steady helped to win the race. And it says Third Act is now digging into work on climate change and they have some specific plans. They ended this saying, we are not your parents' grandparents. So if you think about it, well, let's look at it. And there's one other thing, though. Some people do become interested in issues later in life. Sometimes it's because of a tragic thing that happens, like their child being shot at school or killed by police. They join these clubs that no one ever wants to be in. And we should realize that this works on both sides. There are middle-aged and older people who were indifferent to politics until something they saw in the media or on Facebook or heard from someone made them think that their children were now being threatened in school by wokeism. So this can happen on all sides. But it makes sense that many of us are not one-issue activists. As long as 30 years ago, I heard a speaker explain how racism, sexism, homophobia, militarism, disregard of nature, and so on, are all part of the paradigm of domination. One person or group is better than another and is justified in maintaining that domination by any means. A different view would be one of partnership or community, such as the seventh UU principle about the interconnected web of which we are a part. So I would like to hear from some of you what issues have activated you and then how you have branched out since. I don't know if we have anyone here who's actually been to jail for a cause, but things like working at the food pantry, while less dramatic, are also very important to the community. This is not just about, oh, someone might be in jail for overnight. People lose their jobs. People might lose their spouse over these things, or might lose their home. It takes a lot. And GSA, Gay Straight Alliance, right, in case anyone didn't know. And I don't know if you can even call it that in Florida these days, or you know what would be happening if you were living in Florida or some other states might even be tougher to pursue. And as far as the Second Amendment, I would be fine with everybody having a like musket. You know, that would slow things down a lot. And they didn't have any automatic weapons back then. Thanks, everyone. And our closing words are from Helen Keller. Although the world is full of suffering, it is also full of the overcoming of it. It is wonderful how much time good people spend fighting the devil. If they would only expend the same amount of energy loving their fellow men, the devil would die in his own tracks of ennui.